If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
Seven long days in your burning place. Take it from my temple to my heart, but I can't stay sane. Can't stay sane. Can't stay sane. Oh, I love to make the bell ring. Cause ain't no man in this town long. Sink his soul, sink his soul. Everybody gotta pay the toll. I can't tell you all that's on my mind, but I can't still sing. Can't still sing. Can't still sing. While I hammer down the nail and string. This is a hammer that killed John Henry.
You've been listening to Work Song, I Can Still Sing, off of Chris Jacob's new album, One of These Days. And yes, that's Lindsay Liu accompanying him on vocals. We've waited 5 long years for noted singer-songwriter Chris Jacobs to release new music. Fortunately, his latest effort, One of These Days, is now available wherever you buy and listen to music, and it's one of my favorite albums of the year so far. Backed by the infamous String Dusters and produced by Jerry Douglas, the new album is a blend of rock, soul, gospel, and of course, bluegrass. Obviously, we had to talk to Chris about the new record, mental health, and much more. Have a listen. You haven't released music in 5 years. What's been up?
Well, we had that whole pandemic thing.
Yeah.
Sort of erased two years of our lives. Didn't release. That will still get released one of these days. And, you know, sort of going through some stuff and just decided to shelf it and make a bluegrass album because that's what I felt like doing.
Well, if you're going to make a bluegrass record and you have the ability to call in people like Jerry Douglas to produce the record and the infamous String Dusters to back you on the record and to have, you know, our friend Lindsay Liu join you and Billy Strings, I mean, yeah, I'd want to make a bluegrass record too if I had all of those people at my disposal. How do you even reach out to Jerry Douglas to say, hey, would you like to produce my record?
Yeah, so I met Jerry. He was playing right after me at a festival, Dell Fest, a couple years ago, and or maybe like 2 years ago. And he was sitting there watching my set, and I looked over and saw him watching, and obviously was, you know, nervous and terrified, but you know, after the set, he couldn't have been nicer and more gracious and complimentary and just such a nice guy and really easy going guy. And so we hit it off, and then we bumped into each other again at Telluride, and then when this idea popped into my head of you know, getting back to the bluegrass roots, which were pretty deep in my bag, he was the first person I thought of. I said, you know what, I'm gonna hit up Jerry and see if he'd be into this. And it was just, he said yes. It was easy as that. And then all the pieces kind of fall into place once you have Jerry Douglas on board.
I'm curious about the choice of the Infamous String Dusters, not because they're not a top tier bluegrass band, but because you're such good friends with Green Sky Bluegrass that it's yeah. Interesting that you chose the other great contemporary bluegrass band.
Don't be starting any beefs here, Ira. No, well, actually, I did a session with the Dusters on one of their songs before this all happened, and jokingly I said in the studio, man, this is fun, I'd love to make a bluegrass album and hire you guys as the band. And so that was, you know, sort of the impetus of that idea. And there was also talk at the beginning that I was going to do this on their label, so that was sort of like how the conversation all got started.
Got it.
And you know, yeah, obviously you know, I love Green Sky Bluegrass as well, and it wasn't you're better than them kind of thing.
No,
or the way it all fell into place like that. You know, we floated the idea of hiring like a mandolin player, a bass player, but I liked the idea of trying to get like a band as my band that like knew how to play together and spoke the same language together, and you know, on paper it seemed like a great idea, and it actually did work out really well.
To say this is just a bluegrass album really doesn't do all the songs on the album justice. It's a folk album. It's a blues album. There's tinges of gospel on this album. I would imagine that your influences are quite wide and deep. Do you think about when you're penning these songs, you know, how are we going to deal with them melodically, stylistically? Is that something that you think about when you're writing the song, or is that something that sort of comes after once you've put pen to paper and have sort of written the lyrics and some of the music?
Yeah, both of those things happen. I mean, generally speaking, when I set out to do this record, it was more defined than probably anything else I had done up to that point, because I knew I was making a quote-unquote bluegrass album. I knew Jerry was producing it. I knew the Dusters were going to be the band. So I wrote all the tunes like on my acoustic guitar and sort of with that, you know, in mind. But, you know, when having a guy like Jerry was really helpful, because he could hear me play these songs and say, well, I think we can, you know, do this to it, change the tempo to this, and we'll get the McCrary sisters to sing on it. And, you know, he was very instrumental in sort of some of the arrangements and feels of the songs. And, you know, also, I mean, I knew going into it that it wasn't going to be a Flattened Scruggs album, that it, you know, it wasn't going to sound like that, just because of the nature of how I am, and I'm not a straight anything just stylistically. So I figured it was just a good sort of springboard for me to help define the mission, you know what I mean? And so yeah, it was like I thought I heard the way things were going to sound, and sometimes they did, and then sometimes it was totally different.
You mentioned that, you know, it's not a Scruggs record. Billy Strings, he is on the tips of the mouth of everybody involved in the industry these days because of what an incredible player he is and what a decent guy he is. I mean, his reputation precedes him not only in terms of what he plays and how he plays. Is that intimidating for a guitar player with the amount of experience that you have to sit and watch, or is it just really exciting to sit and watch Billy do his thing?
It's really exciting. You know, the intimidation thing is in a good way. Mm-hmm. The only people that I really would like to be around that intimidate me are the ones that like inspire me. You know, there's no ego or competitive vibe going on with him.
There are a lot of personal songs on the record. One of them is Daughter, Daughter, and it's a conversation that you have with your audience about considering the idea of your children leaving for school, your two daughters leaving for school, and what the history for them might be like. As a father of two daughters who are away at school, it was really relatable. How cathartic is it for you to write about personal things and put them out there? Is it meditative? Is it cathartic? Like, what is it about getting that personal in your inspiration that forces you to do it?
I mean, yeah, it's everything, especially with something like that. Like, there are certain topics that are more lighthearted that, you know, yeah, you can write about it and it's fun, but then there's certain things like that where like you just need to somehow express it or you're gonna scream. And that was sort of like what that was. It actually started, I was having a phone conversation with Paul Hoffman from Green Sky Bluegrass on after one of the school shootings. I think it was the Uvalde one, one of the real, you know, the really terrible ones. And we were just like, yeah, he's got a daughter. And we were just like, man, what do we do? Like, you know, and we just talked about it for a while. And then when I got off the phone, I sort of just had some thoughts about it. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the only thing I can do to like express it, you know. I mean, I can be an activist and donate to causes, and I do those kinds of things as well. But you know, as an artist, if I can't, you know, that certainly I need to be able to draw from those really intense emotions. So yeah, it was quite cathartic. And then to write the song and then send it to Jerry, and he, you know, was like, I really love this one. We're gonna do this one. That was really cool.
The other thing that's really important to you that comes through on this record, specifically in Queen of the Avenue, because of the horror historical facts based on the character set in Baltimore, is your hometown of Baltimore, or at least where you reside now. And it's a common backdrop on the theme, you know, throughout the record. How, you know, being somebody who is from the Baltimore area, there aren't, you know, a ton of bluegrass musicians from that region. I think of Pigeons of Playing Ping Pong or another band from the Baltimore area that sound nothing like you, obviously. But how important is it to stay rooted in the Baltimore area and to make sure that you mention that that's where you're from?
Yeah, well, they're un you know, unknown to a lot of people. Baltimore used to be a huge bluegrass hotbed
Oh,
back
wow.
in the 70s and 60s, 70s. There was a lot of clubs, and I mean the McCurries used to they lived in York, PA. They used to come down here all the time. Bill Monroe passed through here all the time. My grandfather owned a Western clothing store and had like a couple guys in like Don Reno and Bill Monroe's band working for him. And you know, it was like DC and Baltimore were huge. So you know, that being said, you know, there are a lot of pickers around here. And so like, you know, growing up when I was getting into it, there was always like people to play with and stuff like that. But yeah, Baltimore, it's a colorful place. And it's, you know, it's as I was kind of writing these songs, I wanted to keep that connection alive because I wanted it to be re relatable to things that I knew about and into the place that I came from. You know, so I definitely sort of drew back on some historical facts, you know, wrote some stories, and you know, there's a couple songs on the record that are very, very Baltimore centric. But yeah, it's always been important to me, especially with this record where I felt like I was kind of getting back to some roots and really just keeping it real, you know.
How did you meet Lindsay Lou?
I met Lindsay Lou through the festival scene, you know. I think the first time we met was at a Aiken Bluegrass Festival when I did a thing with Billy Strings. We did a thing called the Billy Strings Psychedelic Circus where my band, Electric Band, backed up Billy on electric guitar for like a late night psychedelic set, you know, 4 hour set. And Lindsay sat in, actually Neil Casal sat in. And it was pretty amazing. That was the first time I met her. And then since then we just, you know, we're sort of on like a somewhat parallel trajectory. It seems like, you know, we're always kind of popping up at the same festivals, and we have kind of a very similar group of friends in the scene, and she's just so talented. She's when she came in the studio to sing Work Song, and she just blew us all away, just like how easy it was for her. We recorded it live, just me and her singing at the same time, like what you hear on the record, and then she just, you know, went in and it's like, I got another harmony I could throw on. I got another, and like in one take, just nailed it. And we're just sitting there going, God, is she good?
Yeah, it's a shame that not enough people know about how talented she is and what an amazing voice she is. I mean, we see her in the scene, but it would be great if she could, you know, branch out a little bit more because she is so talented.
Absolutely. Writes great songs too. Yeah, she's great. She's coming to Baltimore in 2 days to play my album release show with me. So I'm excited about that.
So speaking on getting out on the road, you've been a guy who's always toured. You do have a bunch of dates coming up in May. Is mm-hmm. the plan to, I guess, do a lot of the festival scene into June and July? Is that stuff that you want to talk about? Is it stuff that we can assume that you'll be out on the road in the summer months?
Yeah, no, I mean, my schedule's open book. It's up there. Yeah, in May, I'm going out and doing a whole tour with Tommy Emmanuel, which should be absolutely mind-blowing. And then summertime's gonna be, you know, the summertime thing, doing a couple festivals and some other you know, concert series. I'm doing these cool gigs in Denver with two of the guys from the String Dusters that do this like Bluegrass Generals super group thing. Mm-hmm. Doing that, and then fall comes and it's more festivals and more shows, and hopefully my family remembers me and still loves me.
Are you somebody who's always writing stuff? Are you leaving yourself voice notes or putting writing stuff down in notes on your phone? Like what's that process like for you? Because I would imagine you're so inspired by being at all of these events and talking to all of these people and listening to so much music.
I wish I was like the guy who sits down and writes for 3 hours every day, but I'm not. I used to kind of dabble in that, and you know, I just don't have the time necessarily, but I definitely am always writing down. So my process kind of works where like I start very general, or like start with a very simple idea. Like if something just hits me in my mind or I hear a phrase or something, I'll jot it down on my phone. And I have a whole bunch of those. And then there comes the time where I sit down with my guitar, and sometimes I just paint some abstract guitar ideas, piece it together with some of the lyrical ideas. It's a very messy process. It's not like, okay, I have this fully realized song, I'm going to go sit down and write it. No, it's always like, I start simple. I start general. I start just kind of throwing paint against the wall. And then as things start to take shape, then I have the different stages where I can sit down and do editing and sit down and really try to hone in on, okay, here's the idea that I like. Now how can I develop it even better? So, you know, it's just, it's kind of, I am always trying to catch hold of sparks, I guess you could say, that I then, you know, go through my whole process with one by one to try to make songs out of them. It's not easy. It's never been easy for me, and it seems to get harder and harder, but I guess, I don't know, maybe that's the way it's supposed to be.
So there are 11 songs on this record. Does that mean there are more songs that you have written already than that we won't be waiting 5 years till the next record?
You won't be waiting 5 years. That's for sure. I mean, I'm already. Yes, that is the case. And like I said, I do have one in the can already that, you know, I don't know if I'm going to put it out before the next one or what, but, you know, I do already have another record done. And then I do have other songs that didn't make, you know, this particular record that I could get started with on the next one, and lots of ideas that once I get, you know, some block off some time to sit down and crack open the treasure chest, I will definitely start chipping away at.
One song that I think is so important and really relatable for me, and I'm sure lots of people, is the final song on the record. And so I thought it appropriate to mention it here as we conclude our chat. Everybody's lost. And, you know, I think the pandemic especially really brought out a lot of people's inner emotions and the stuff that they struggle with. And I know that certainly it's documented that, you know, you went through some of your own battles and certainly sought help for those. How important is it for you to share the message of everybody's loss, that it's not just, you know, you or I dealing with these issues, that we kind of all are sort of dealing with this stuff?
Yeah, I think it's super important. And you know, it was like a simple realization that I came to, that you know, it was like I was sort of carrying around this weight for a while that I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know why I wasn't happier or more productive or more focused or more present with my family or just, you know, more happy with my work or doing better at it. And it was, you know, it's and I just came to the realization that, like, you don't just because I'm not like an alcoholic or my wife's not kicking me out or like that, you know, that doesn't mean I don't need help, or it doesn't mean that I don't need to get a hold of my life a little better and that I can't be living a more fulfilled life. And so I, you know, seek some help and figured out my own thing. But I think I'm still figuring it out, you know, and I think the bottom line is that we all are, and that like we're all a little bit, you know, seeking and searching and not 100% all the time, and it's okay. And I think just admitting that and helping people like feel seen and related in that way, and knowing that they're not the only ones that might have the, you know, it's like it was so it's a silly thing, but I think especially with men, like it's there's sort of like a pride about admitting, you know, depression or just that you're not like fully able to handle your shit, you know. Getting over that was the simple thing for me of just saying, you know what, it's okay that I feel this way, and it's okay that I want to go get therapy and maybe take medication and start figuring shit out. And I think it was the best thing that I ever did. And I just think it's a simple message that, like, if everybody just accepted that we're all a little fucked up. You know, maybe it'll just the empathy and the way we treat each other will all be better, and that, you know, we can all kind of get through it.
It's kind of a shame that, you know, we've lost a lot of people in the last, I would say, five or 6 years to mental health and issues of that ilk. And then an organization like Backline gets started, and it's so important for you as musicians and for the people that work on your tour and to have those services available to you. Is that something that, you know, you want to contribute to? Is that something that you think is important? I mean, obviously it's important, but that for you as somebody who struggled and has friends, you know, you mentioned Neil Casal earlier, who struggle with these same things, like, you know, it's better to get help and better to seek help from an organization like Backline than to just kind of unfortunately give up, right?
Right, exactly. Yes. I mean, I want to do everything that I can to help people, you know, especially as artists. And I mean, not especially as artists, but artists for sure. We deal with this all the time. We're out there like giving away parts of ourself, and you know, in a career that's not very forgiving, you know, on the road, away from our families, away from comforts, and it's just like these short-lived pleasures and then crashes, and you know, and then constantly needing to put more out and do something fresh and reinvent, and you know, and that can just be, it can be really taxing on your emotions, especially in a business that can be very unforgiving and make you feel like nothing's working and therefore you're worthless. And you know, there's a lot to it. And yeah, I think especially these days, you know, and raising kids, as you know, it's like mental health among children is really on the rise. And I think it's all the device. I sound like a cranky old boomer over here, but like, you know, it's there's just yeah, I feel like it's a conversation that just needs to be normalized, that's all, and that we all need to feel comfortable admitting if things don't feel exactly right, and there needs to be resources for people. I mean, you know, you talk about the guns thing, and you know, Republicans want to talk about mental health. Oh, it's mental health. And where are the programs to help mental health then? You know, because yes, mental health is an issue.
along with guns, but let's do mental health then. And, you know, obviously that's a whole other conversation that we don't have. But yeah, I mean, long and short of it is, I think it's the most important thing. I think, you know, if your head's not right, like your life's not going to be right, and your work's not going to be right, and your relationships aren't going to be right. And, you know, so it's just, it's such a snowball effect. And me just getting a simple hold on a few things, or it wasn't like major life adjustments. It wasn't like drastic changes, but a couple little things, you know, in my ways of thinking, in my habits, in my, you know, that have worked wonders for me. And I was able to, you know, write a whole record and be happy doing it and play inspired. And, you know, I go out and play and I'm happy doing it. I mean, you know, there's good and bad days, obviously. And yeah. But it, you know, it's, it was definitely the best thing for me to just admit it and to just like try to work it out.
Well, if this record is a result of you getting better and getting yourself more organized, not necessarily organized to the nth degree, but better organized, let's say that. I think you're doing amazing things, because from the start of this record till the end, it's not something that you want to turn off. I mean, it's the all the different styles, all the different guests, the messages of these songs. I mean, you really have put together an album worth waiting for, and I guess worth going through some personal trouble to get to. Are you proud of these 11 songs and the record that is One of These Days?
Super proud, man. Super proud. I usually, when I finish a record, like, have such a love-hate relationship with it, where like I don't even want to listen to it, and then it takes me like a year until I like it again. I still have not gone through that with this one. And yeah, you know, I can still listen to it and enjoy it, and I think it's an amazing record. I think it sounds incredible. I think the playing is incredible, the engineering, the production, like every that the team that I had on this record was just such an A squad all around. And and I think the songs came out good, and I'm super happy with it.
Great. Well, thanks so much for taking the time and for letting us know about some of the inner workings of these tunes and of your life. And we can't thank you enough, Chris. Thanks for taking the time, dude. And I'm glad we were able to get this done.
Good to talk to you again, Ira. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure chatting with not only a great singer-songwriter, but one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. Talented AF, too. For more, visit chrisjacobs.com. Before we leave you, let's listen to Daughter Daughter off of One of These Days, featuring Jerry Douglas on lap steel.
Daughter, daughter, flesh and blood, if I could rid it all, I would. Every bullet that I found and melted down into the ground. Hopeless feeling that I can't see what's coming around the bend. Gotta keep my eyes wide open, but be blind enough to cope. And don't forget to say your prayers, brush your teeth and comb your hair. Fetishes force us all to live like this. Such a pity, such a crime. Ain't no reason, ain't no rhyme. Too much dumb luck just to make it out alive, for goodness sake. And don't forget to say a prayer, brush your teeth and comb your hair. So young and so aware. Certain things should last a while, like innocence, a simple child. Darling, darling, I believe that kindness kills the poison seed. One divine need in the heart can blow the devil all apart. And don't forget to say your prayers, brush your teeth and comb your hair. So darling, darling, flesh and blood, if I could rid it all I would. Every bullet that I found, I melted down into the ground.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.